Good evening. I promise this will be shorter than the last time. I'm really sorry. So do this if you see me lingering on. So let me ask you a question as our beginning tonight. What would you think if our government proposed a law that forced any person who was in a position to influence public opinion and moral conduct to be required to commit public acts that demonstrated their allegiance to the nation and an accepted code of conduct, moral conduct? If somebody's, for example, a politician, or if they were an entertainer or a sports figure, that the government's proposal would be that they do things that show that they are faithful to the nation, that they have allegiance to the United States, and that they're adhering to a code of moral conduct. People in the military, officers in the military, yes. News anchors. Anybody that's influencing public opinion. A generally accepted moral code of the country. In the United States, is it moral for someone to commit adultery? You can make a motion. Is it? Is that considered moral? Okay. I mean, our country, you know, sometimes we think maybe they don't, but our country does have moral standards. Everybody knows what they are. You're not supposed to do this. Okay. Yeah, and actually on like network TV, there still is, right? I mean, there's some things you don't say.
Yes. Okay.
Well, if you go in, okay, I guess I'm connecting. What if you go into the military? One of the things you have to do is take a pledge that says that you will do so. So if you go in the military, definitely you have to do the Pledge of Allegiance thing, right? Okay. Follow orders, the whole bit. Yes?
I guess I would be a little wary that the government is the one who is setting what those standards are.
Okay.
You know, if the people had a vote on what those standards were, I'd feel a little more comfortable. But I'm afraid of what the government would say those standards are supposed to be.
Okay. Yes?
First of all, God has already set up our moral code, and if we just follow that, there wouldn't be a problem.
Okay, God has defined what is righteousness for us, right? Not so we can prove how good we are, but because it's a blessing if you live according to the way God told you to. Okay? All right, well, that's our setup. You know, there have been periods in U.S. history when this really did happen. If you go back to the time of the Civil War and Reconstruction, the whole idea of the Pledge of Allegiance, it was after the war and Reconstruction, you either took the Pledge of Allegiance or you weren't there anymore. Right? That's how that worked. During World War II, there were some things that happened, and particularly the ones that I think you probably will be most familiar with, or during the communist scare of the late 40s and the early 50s. Do some of you remember that? Oh, yeah. Okay. So in each of one of these, citizens were forced to do things to demonstrate their loyalty. And as far as I can tell, none of these things actually happened because of a law. You know, in World War II, there were a lot of communities that were German communities, and everybody spoke German. Do you know what happened to speaking German in the United States during World War II? It was the end of it. So I have a friend, his name's Jim Miller. Some of you might know Jim Miller. He stands about this tall. Until he started school, he didn't speak a word of English. And right now, you know, he doesn't speak a word of German. And that all changed just like that when that war broke out. For the Japanese, it was a little tougher. You know, Japanese were rounded up and put in internment camps, and they stayed there for the whole war. And the people that were there that were of the right age could get out of the camp. The way they did it was they joined the military, and they got shipped to Europe to fight. But following the war is the part I think we know the most about. It's about there was this rapid and violent expansion of communism, and the government was unwilling to do things, to take military steps to oppose it, but they were really concerned about it. The government began a program of purging communist sympathizers. One of the very first ones to go, one of the most public ones to go, was an Iowan. Anybody know who Henry A. Wallace was? He was an avowed communist sympathizer. At the time, he was vice president of the United States, and he was out. That's how Harry Truman got to be vice president of the United States. They dumped him because of his communist ties. Did any of you watch the movie Julie and Julia? This is the movie about the young woman that went through Julia Child's cookbook and cooked every single thing. You know, in that movie, did any of you see that? Well, there's a couple of you that did. You remember there was a section in this that Julia Child's husband, Paul, was recalled to Washington. And he was hoping that it was because they were going to ask his opinion about things, but it was for an inquisition. And it talked about the tremendous effect that it had on his life, because what happened at that time was they were grilling people. He was a State Department official. And they went back and just basically ran him through the ringer, you know, and asked him all sorts of questions that he didn't think had anything to do with anything. But what they were doing was trying to purge the government of anybody that was sympathetic to communism. So they went through a lot of things like that. And there have been times. So Joseph McCarthy, anybody hear of Joseph McCarthy? So he was a senator from Wisconsin, and he started something called the Hearing on Un-American Activities. And anybody that it was even rumored that was doing anything that was sympathetic to communists, he'd haul them in front of the committee, basically ruin their lives. There were a lot of people who were entertainers that were basically forced out of business. I mean, they became blacklisted because they couldn't do anything, even if there wasn't proof that they were guilty. In fact, I think today, some of that, and it's a little what I think some of you were saying is about being nervous that the government got in that business. I think a lot of the extremes that the entertainment industry goes to prove that they can do absolutely anything that they want to, no matter how bad it is, was in response to what McCarthy did to them, McCarthyism. So they're going to these extremes to prove that you just can't make us behave ourselves, which isn't a good thing either. But that's probably why they're doing it. Why did I bring these things up? I'm really trying to set the stage for what happened in the first few centuries of the church. And really to confront that sometimes there are some good reasons. Frankly, I expect you to have a little more sympathy for that idea. You know, the thing is if somebody's influencing public opinion and they're making their living influencing public opinion, I think that they do have some responsibility. There ought to be some kind of I personally think that there ought to be some kind of regulation for anybody that's in the public eye like that. And really to remind us of a thing that I think Janice was saying is that even though that sounds like a good idea, it's the kind of thing that has a tendency to go overboard and to get out of hand and go too far. Most reasonable people think that those activities do so. Well, the church went in a period, and last time that I was with you, this is a series of lessons that Glenn suggested, and so I'm still kind of sticking on that tack. Tell me when it's time to get off the tack. But, you know, when we talked about this, we talked about the time when the church was really quite innocent, the way that the Lord has intended it. And after three centuries, the church was really into full-blown apostasy. It was also those first three centuries of the Roman Empire that took place. You know, I made the point in the last lesson that the Roman Empire did not have as its empire policy persecuting Christians. Christians were indeed persecuted, but it wasn't because that the Roman government set out to do that. In the accounts that we read in the Bible, the thing that you see every time is that Jesus and his followers were persecuted at the instigation of jealous religious leaders. The Romans may have become involved, but they didn't become involved because they were trying to persecute Christians. They became involved because they were trying to maintain the peace. And sometimes Christians were punished because they were in the middle of not maintaining the peace. It was not a general policy. The exterminations that took place under Vespasian and Titus, two of the Roman emperors, they were directed at the Jews. And in fact, these two were carrying out what God promised the Jews would happen if they were unfaithful to Him. He promised them. In fact, He made them recite, here's what's going to happen to us if we're unfaithful. Vespasian and Titus brought that upon them. Christians only got in on that event if they still tried to remain Jews, because it was being Jews that was being exterminated. In the next three centuries, there were other persecutions of Christians and other religious groups. There's generally attributed, if you go back and read in an encyclopedia or any kind of reference book, there were 10 periods of persecution that involved 11 different emperors. A few of them, actually, I think, were well-intentioned. They were exactly what I suggested, that the government was trying to make sure that its citizens were loyal to the Roman Empire, and they were trying to encourage their citizens to fill a specific moral conduct, the morals of Rome. Some of them were absolutely purely evil, and some of them, it's a little hard to tell. They were probably a mixture of both. The first two, you know, we talked about one of them, Nero. Nero and Domitian were the first two emperors who persecuted Christians. Both of these guys were plain, pure evil. Their persecution of Christians was intended to draw fire away from themselves. They were trying to make somebody else get all of the attention, all of the negative attention, because they were doing bad things and they really didn't want to call attention to themselves. Both of them came to violent and sudden ends as a consequence of their actions. They're both emperors who went into the Hall of Shame of Rome. The next two, Trajan and Marcus Aurelius, again in the movies. You watch the movie Gladiator, Marcus Aurelius was one of the characters in that. He was a real person. He was the philosopher emperor. These two were a little different, that they actually came back and they were listed as two of the five good emperors. So when you read Roman history, you hear about the five good emperors. These were two of them. But they were trying to do exactly what I suggested, that they were trying to get the people that lived in the empire to be loyal to the empire and follow a moral code. They did not actually go after Christians just to rout all the Christians, however. Things like jealous religious leaders. Trajan was one of the fellows that I think you probably could say that he started this whole idea of don't ask, don't tell. That when someone would report, you know, so-and-so is a Christian, he told his officials, don't go investigate those things. Because if this is just some kind of a jealousy report that somebody's trying to get us to attack Christians, we don't want to do that. What they were doing is that they were going after people who were causing trouble. He said that investigating these cases where somebody turned someone in as a Christian, in his words, not worth our time. That's not what he was trying to do. Then the next four actually did persecute the church. And they were primarily acting to try to suppress the church and slow down its growth. Their names were Septimus. He ruled from 193 to 211. Maximinus, who ruled from 235 to 238. Decius, who ruled from 249 to 251. And Valerian, from 253 to 260. Decius, the third of these, was the first emperor that actually issued a decree that said that his policy was to persecute Christians. The effect, however, of these persecutions backfired. What it did in all four cases is that it turned public opinion against the emperor and in favor of Christians. Christianity actually grew during this period. The effect was that they saw Christians who went to their deaths in some cases, that they were professing their faith in Christ and they were not resisting the government, and they died noble deaths. Sarah said she wanted a Texas example, so I'll give you one. You might not like this example, though, Sarah. Any of you ever visit the Alamo? In the Alamo, it talks about what happened, and there was a commander in the Alamo. His name was William Travis. There was a supreme commander of their effort. His name was Sam Houston. Sam Houston sent envoys in to see William Travis, and he gave him some specific orders, what he wanted to do about the Alamo. Anybody remember what that was? I'll give you the refresher. He said, destroy the powder magazine, get the cabin, the cannon, and all of these men out of there to safety and bring them to rejoin the main force. William Travis did not do that. He stayed and fought Santa Ana, and they all died. Well, if you were a military commander, so Kurt, and the military commander said, I want you to evacuate these men, I want you to destroy the ammunition, and I want you to bring the equipment and the men safely to another place, and that commander doesn't do it, what's the position of his commanding officer? Okay, that means he'd get court-martialed, right? He wouldn't be the commanding officer anymore. Was William Travis being a good officer and doing what he was told by Sam Houston? No, he wasn't. He was kind of a bad example as a military man. However, here he was, a bad egg. And when he died, what did they do with him? He became some kind of a cult hero. He became a martyr for their cause. You know, that's what was happening to some Christians during this period. There were people, if you know anybody that is a Christian that's just a troublemaker? Have you ever ran across anybody like that? Yeah, you have. What do you think happened with them during this period of time? I mean, and certainly there were people who were not troublemakers that were trying to do the right thing. I mean, there are all kinds of people in that case. But when you have a policy like this going on by the government, it has a tendency to weed out all of those troublemakers. What do you think would happen to the church if all the troublemakers disappeared? What do you think would happen to the church if all the troublemakers disappeared and they were perceived by the general public as being heroes? You think that would hurt the church? You do? If all of the troublemakers disappeared and the general public looked at the church and thought of those people as heroes, did it hurt the cause of the battle for Texas? No, it didn't. And it didn't with these guys either. So there were people that were suffering. Yeah, sure. There were people that were just basically troublemakers that were being weeded out of the church. Certainly during this period, the church grew and it became stronger because of the persecution, not weaker, for whatever the reason. Most sources agree that the most severe persecution of the church under the Roman Empire happened under the reign of two guys, Diocletian and Galerius, between the years 303 and 305. And we're really going to talk about that this evening. I'm not going to go into the details in this part where we're talking about the setup for this, but most of them agree that that was the most severe persecution. And they say that somewhere between 3,000 and 3,500 Christians died under their persecution in those 3 years. 3,500. Now let me ask you, when you think about your general impression from things that you've seen in the movies or read in some popular book, how many Christians did you think were killed in religious persecutions in the Roman Empire? Was it a small number like 3,000 to 3,500? Or was it in the millions? You always thought it was a bigger number. So, and the point of this is that in many cases, the deaths and the suffering and the losses of Christians at the hands of the Roman Empire were very often exaggerated. When you think about the persecutions of Christians compared to, for example, the persecution that the Romans put on the Jews, do you think that the Romans only killed 3,000 Jews? No, they wiped them out. I mean, they decimated their population. They were down to a very small number where they'd been in the millions before. This persecution was not nearly as severe as sometimes I think we're led to believe. And most of the people who actually were suffering were leaders of the church, some of them for righteous reasons and some for not. And the main effect of the persecutions that happened was that it turned public opinion away from the people who were doing the persecutions and in favor of the church. The last persecution that happened was very brief. It only happened for a couple of years, and it's kind of a strange persecution, but it's generally listed. It was by a guy named Julian, Julian the Apostate. His persecution took the form that there was a period at which that the church had, the Roman Empire had adopted the church as the official religion of the empire, and they had branded certain people as heretics, and they had been exiled from the Roman Empire. What Julian did was is he brought those people back, and he mixed them back into the church. So what happens when the church has more troublemakers for a change? We have more grief. That was his persecution, is that he brought the people that was going to cause strife and division in the church back and planted them back with the churches. So with that background, I'd like to bring us back to the period from 303 to 324. This is the period of Constantine the Great. He's also known as Constantine the First, Saint Constantine by the Catholic Church. His official name was Caesar Flavius Constantinus Valerius Augustus. He was born in 272. He ruled the empire, the western part of the empire, from 306 to 324. And then from 324 to 337, he ruled the whole empire. He was the son of a soldier whose name was Constantinus. And his informal wife or concubine, we talked about concubine, wives or concubines recently in other classes, her name was Helena. She's believed by many to have been a Greek Christian. So his mother was a Christian. Constantine is known for being a good and just emperor. He did many great things. He made the Roman Empire what it should be. He was a wise statesman. He was able to influence public opinion. He was a shrewd politician. Some Protestants accuse him of corrupting the church. And my view of him has changed in making this study, I have to tell you. You know, let's think about the era that they were living in. You know, usually when you think about the emperor of the Roman Empire, where do you think he lives? Rome, right? They lived about every place except Rome during that time. When you think about the ruler of the Roman Empire, you think about somebody who is in charge of a vast and powerful and well-organized political system. That wasn't true either. Nothing like that. The Roman Empire at the time was so large that it was really impossible for one man to rule it. They were divided by a lot of things. The biggest one was language. And usually what happened is that even if there was one guy that was in charge, he would place subordinates in place who would rule for him in the various parts of the Roman Empire. The most typical division was between the eastern part, which was Greek-speaking, and it went from generally Greece to the east and to the south, and the Latin-speaking part, which went from Italy to the north and west. That because of language, they were separated, so that, you know, they didn't speak the same language the people didn't, so the governments were nationally separated in that way. It was fairly common for the people that ruled those to have subordinates that were sort of their Caesars in training. And so they would have several people, sometimes as many as five people, who were all called Caesar because they had different roles in the government. In 306, Constantine became one of three such Caesars. So let's look a little at the timeline. So let's look at the timeline and go back to 284. 284 was the year that Diocletian became the supreme Roman emperor. He appointed three Caesars to help him rule. Their names were Maximus, Gallus, and Constantinus. This is Constantine's father. And actually, Maximian was his father-in-law because he'd married his daughter. So these people were all kind of connected. Together, these four expanded the empire. They defeated their enemies. They were good negotiators, and they were able to make the empire be consolidated and grow. Diocletian reformed the tax code and made it fairer. And then he started jacking up the taxes. In fact, he was the fellow who is credited of having the highest tax rate during the Roman Empire. He used that money to expand the government. So the bureaucracy of the government expanded, and the control of the government and people's lives expanded under him. In 303, he and especially one of his co-emperors Gallerus, decided that the Christians were a problem, and they decided to have a persecution of Christians. They put out an edict that said the Christians were going to be persecuted. Maxim and Constantinus, they did not oppose the edict, but they didn't enforce it either. So what happened was is that there was this edict that you were going to persecute Christians, and in the western part, essentially what happened to the Christians there was that they only came under this edict and were punished if they caused some kind of problem. And it was to go back to the same don't ask, don't tell thing. If the Christians weren't causing a problem, they were left alone. But in the eastern part, where Gallerus, where he ruled, this is the area where that they were actually routing people out. I mean, that most of the people that they lost their property or they lost their lives in this area because they were trying to root out Christianity in this area. The thing that they would do is that they'd go to the leaders, and if you were an officer in the army, if you were an official in the government, or if you were any kind of public figure, and for example, the leaders in local churches were public figures, the thing that they would be required to do is pledge allegiance to the Roman Empire and sacrifice to the Roman gods. So this is like offering a sacrifice to Jupiter. So you either did this, or you either lost your property, or you were killed. Many churches, if the church leaders did not agree to do this, what they would do is destroy the church. So they would lose like the church building, they'd tear it down around them. Most of the deaths were likely subject to offering resistance. There were three important outcomes out of this period. The first one is that Diocletian was actually forced to abdicate because of this persecution added to the reasons that he would abdicate. He was forced from office. This was only 2 years of persecution that took place. Because many Christians complied with the order to offer sacrifice to the Roman gods, the other thing that happened within the church is that there was a severe division because of this. So the thing that would happen is that if the leaders of this church said, you know, this doesn't mean anything to us, let's go give them their stupid sacrifice, and, you know, they can kill a pigeon down at the temple of Jupiter and say it's in our name and we don't care, it doesn't mean anything to us, just do it. And they did, and they saved the church. Okay, that was their logic. Others went back and said, no, we're not going to do anything remotely like that. And they lost the church, they lost their property, sometimes they lost their lives. Well, you can imagine what kind of sore feelings this made between Christians. So it created this huge division in the church between people that refused to do anything to comply with the Roman demands and suffered because of it, and the people that did the minimum that they could to get by. And, you know, what would you do in that circumstance? I mean, think about it. What would you do? But certainly because people took different choices, it created a huge division. And, of course, the third part is what I already mentioned. It was a period in which the church actually grew. Because of what was going on in the persecution, the church grew. Because especially when the leaders stood up to the Romans, and the leaders may have been led away to their death, and they showed valiantly that they believed in the Lord, even if it cost them their lives, this had this great impact on the people around them. In 305, Diocletian was forced to abdicate. As soon as he abdicated power, as long as he was in charge, his subordinates got along with each other. Guess what happened the minute he wasn't emperor anymore? They went to plotting and fighting between each other. In the west, you had Constantinus and Maxim. Maxim was the Diocletian abdicated in 2005, and Constantinus' son Constantine killed Maxim, the other emperor, in that same year. And the next year, there was an emperor called Gallerus. He lived for a few years, and he went to 311 when he was succeeded by a guy named Licinius. So all of these people were fighting with each other. It was civil war that broke out in the country. There was something that Gallerus wrote when he was lying on his deathbed that actually sums up how he felt about what he and Diocletian were doing. And I'd just like to read it to you. This is translated from Latin into English, but I think in his own words it tells us how he saw what was happening. Okay, so I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but it's how he saw it. He said, among all the other arrangements that we're always making for the benefit and utility of the state, we have heretofore wished to repair all things in accordance with the laws and public discipline of the Romans, and to ensure that even the Christians who abandoned the practice of their ancestors should return to good sense. Indeed, for some reason or other, such self-indulgence assailed and the idiocy possessed these Christians that they did not follow the practices of the ancients, which their own ancestors had, perhaps instituted, but according to their own will and as it pleased them, they made laws for themselves that they observed, and gathered various peoples in diverse areas. Then, when our order was issued stating that they should return themselves to the practices of the ancients, many were subjected to peril, and many were even killed. Many more persevered in their way of life, and we saw that neither offered proper worship and cult to the gods, or to the God of the Christians. Considering the observation of our own mild clemency and the eternal custom by which we are accustomed to grant clemency to all people, we have decided to extend our most speedy indulgence to these people as well, so that Christians may once more establish their meeting places, so long as they do not act in a disorderly way. We are about to send another letter to our officials detailing the conditions they ought to observe. Consequently, in accord with our indulgence, they ought to pray to their God for our health and the safety of the state, so that the state may be kept safe on all sides, and that they may be able to live safely and securely in their own homes. So in his own words, this is what Gallerus thought he was up to. He died, and he was replaced by Licinius. The very next year, this would be 312, Constantine met one of the other Civil War generals, a guy who was his brother-in-law, named Maxentius. They met at a place, it was a bridge called the Milvian Bridge. Maxentius had 100,000 men. Constantine had 40,000 men. This is one of those important moments in Christian history. Constantine claims that he saw a vision. And in his vision, what he saw was that if he fought in the name of Christ, and if his soldiers bore the emblem of Christ on their shields, that he would prevail. Now, I'm not saying that he saw the vision or that he didn't, but it's what he claimed. And what he did was he had his men put the sign of Christ on their shields. Many of them had no idea what it meant, but it was how the emperor told them that they were going to succeed. Constantine promised that if he did prevail in this battle, that he would serve Christ. And he did prevail, and he killed the other guy, and he won that battle. Is this how one is converted to being a Christian? Not usually. This did not make Constantine a Christian. In fact, there's evidence that he served other gods after this. He was eventually baptized, but it didn't happen until right before he died. The policies that he actually put forward were those that his father had tried to put forward, that is, religious tolerance. It wasn't that he tried to push one religion above another, but it was that he tried to show tolerance to all religions. He may indeed have supported Christianity, but I think that his character would not have supported the persecutions that Christians put on each other after the time they came to be the official religion of Rome. The next year, in 313, Licinius, who was the other guy that was remaining, he actually prevailed over his opponents too. So the two of them, Constantine and Licinius, had conquered the whole Roman Empire and they had it under control. The two of them met and decided that they were going to rule together. Licinius married Constantine's sister, half-sister, and they put out the Edict of Milan. The Edict of Milan said that the official position of the Roman Empire was religious tolerance, that no one would be persecuted or oppressed because of their religion. They signed it, they went away back to their respective homes, and the next year, guess what? They were fighting with each other. They had a civil war and they fought for a few years. They fought it to a draw. In 315, they decided they'd have a truce. The truce lasted until 321. 321, Licinius's people were pursuing an enemy. The enemy went across the border into Constantine's territory and they stopped pursuing them. Constantine picked up and started pursuing them in his territory. He ran them back into Licinius's part of the empire. And it was hot pursuit, so he just kept going. Sound anything like the Korean War? Okay, so it's kind of the history of what happened in the Korean War. Licinius said, you know what? You broke the truce. The truce is over. It was a big mistake for him to say that, because Constantine didn't wait for Licinius to form an army and come attack him. Constantine attacked Licinius right away. It took him a couple of years, but he actually defeated him in 323. He attacked him. He captured him. Remember, Licinius married Constantine's sister. What do you think his sister said? Please don't kill my husband. So he didn't. He put him in jail instead. But the next year, he said, you know what? I think this guy's been conspiring against me. Go hang him. And they did. So here it is, 324. Constantine is the sole emperor of the Roman Empire. So, why do you think these people fought? Have you ever been on the farm and watched chickens? Do you know what the pecking order is? Do you know why they call it the pecking order? Because animals in general, the animal nature is, they just can't be happy until they know which one is superior to the next one. Every chicken's got to have another chicken that they can peck on. It's pecking order. Until those roosters figure out which rooster is the lead rooster, there's not going to be any peace in the chicken yard. Dogs are the same way. Ducks are the same way. Geese are the same way. And unfortunately, so are Roman emperors. Yeah. Okay? So that's exactly what they were. In the book of James, and this is going to be a little light on Scripture tonight, but in the book of James, there's two passages in chapter 3 and chapter 4 that I'd like to share with you. It really talks about what's happening here. James chapter 3, verse 13 through 18. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but it is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealous and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed of those of whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Didn't sound like Constantine and his fellows, did it? James 4, verses 1 through 4, says this. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with the wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. James is speaking to Christians, but I applied it to Constantine to explain why it was that he was fighting. But you know, it still comes back to Christians. So here's Constantine. It's 324. He made the pledge that he's going to serve Christ. He's now completely in control. He's unified the Roman Empire. It's time for him to fulfill on his pledge. He probably didn't know much about what it was to be a Christian when he made that pledge. So he went to see the Christians and looked for the church, and he should have seen unity, and he found division. He found the people that James wrote this to. Instead of having one leader who was Christ, he found many leaders who were arguing with themselves about all sorts of things. You know, you might be able to understand this division that I talked about, where some people had sacrificed to the Roman gods and others hadn't, and they had bitterness in their heart. You might could understand that a little bit. But these people were arguing about things that weren't written in the Bible. You know, they were making up things that had nothing to do with anything written in the Bible. They didn't have any information to have an opinion. And they were forming different opinions and fighting about it. That's what he found. He expected unity. He found division. What was he supposed to find in the church? What did Paul say he was supposed to find in 1 Corinthians? He said that you should be one. So Constantine, and this is the part that I say that I don't think that he corrupted them. I think he found them already corrupt. He told them that they should be unified. Unfortunately, the tack that he took was that he said that what they should do is get all of the bishops that they could find, but because by this time the church had devolved into a condition that every city had a bishop, a single bishop that really ruled the Christians in that one single town. And they had come up with these different ideas. There were two of them that were really the leaders of opposing movements. One was called Alexander. He lived in Alexandria. The other was a guy named Arius. He lived, and I forgot where he lived, I'm sorry. But we'll get to that next time. The two of these came up with this big argument about the nature of Christ. And the argument, and I think you've heard this, is whether or not Christ and God were of the same substance. Have you ever read anything written in the Bible about whether Jesus and God were of the same substance? You didn't, because it's not in there. That's what they were arguing about. Okay? So he saw this terrible thing. He tried to bring religious tolerance to people, and he found Christians who were unwilling to forgive each other from the things that had happened with them. And they were arguing about things that they had no reason to even be concerned with what the answer was to what they were arguing about, much less have any information to do it. So what he did was, is he tried to resolve the bitter disputes by having a committee. So he called 1,800 together, and he had what is called the Council of Nicaea. It happened in 325. So I'm going to pause here, because if I keep going on about this, this will be as long as it was last time. So the next time we get together, what I'd like to do with you is talk about what were they actually arguing about leading up to this council, and what did they decide. But as you look at this, I hope you come away with a little different feeling about Constantine. I don't think it was that he corrupted the church by making it like the Roman government. I think he found a church that was already having problems. He did what he could to try to fix it. It's just that it didn't work. Now, this isn't... Okay, so is that a good stopping spot? This isn't a particularly invitational message. But I know that every time that we come together, there are some of us that need to become Christians. Not the way that Constantine did, the way that God intended. This is giving your heart to God and acknowledging Him. Repenting and confessing and being baptized. There's people in every audience that need to do this. And there are others that need the prayers of the church. If this applies to you, the church stands ready to help you. Kirk, will you come and lead us in song?